All right, anybody close to the picture?
Flowers?
Flowers, okay. Anybody else have anything to say? All right. I love this quote by Spurgeon that says, "I heard a man who said that he did not like to prejudice his boy, so he would not say anything to him about religion. The devil, however, was quite willing to prejudice the boy. So very early in life, he learned to swear, although his father had foolish and wicked objections to teaching him how to pray. If ever you feel it incumbent upon you to not prejudice a piece of ground by sowing the seed on it, you may rest assured that we will not imitate your impartiality. Where the plow does not go and the seed is not sown, the weeds are sure to multiply. And if children are left untrained, all sorts of evil will spring up in their hearts and lives." That summarizes everything Ron just said. It is true, it used to be, that in the church, one of the things we had to worry about most was, are our kids going to believe that Christianity is true? And we're fighting a battle to show that it was true and right. Now, the battleground is different. And culture is saying that to have any morality, to have any kind of these biblical views that we have, is not good. And so we're fighting an uphill battle. You're going to try to keep coming back to this, but starting off with a biblical worldview is so important, because then, especially administering or counseling to young people, then that has directed the foundation for everything we do on how we feel social. And unfortunately, many of us are buying into a secular godly cult system of professionalism. I think professionalism is godless. I think that you're buying into a system that's born of God, which means then how are you going to be counseling for people? Which is why the very next thing we're talking about is the significance of prayer and counseling. Because for the most part, most secular counseling does not believe the parents are significant in the process, and they leave parents out of the process. And you're going to hear me argue very strongly for why, if you're going to counsel kids and teens, you must counsel parents as well. They have to be part of the process. Now, everyone's come up with a formula of how to make them a part of the process. How much are they part of the process? I don't know. Now, in reality, what I think is wisdom. So biblical principles are timeless, however how we contextualize them, and that's what I'm saying about parental involvement. I don't know how parents should be involved. It depends on the age of the child. It depends on what the issues are of the child. It depends on the maturity of the child. It depends on the maturity of the parents. It depends on whether you have access to parents, right? So there's a lot of liberty in how much and how often, and I'm not going to give you principles, and we're going to give you really good principles quickly throughout the next couple of days to talk about, well, here's how I do it. Elijah will say, well, here's how we do it. Or Ron will say, here's how I do it. Because you're going to see that there's actually flexibility. That we can all be different and approach counseling to some degree different than the principles on the thing. Well, why do we do it? What you're hearing me say is parents have to be part of the process. However we do it, then you must be part of the process. Because what I say to parents, and this goes into, tomorrow morning we're going to talk about philosophy of counseling, right? That first in the morning, you're going to hear me start to weigh in on that. My personal opinion is if I'm going to counsel a child or teen, I'm going to counsel a parent. Now, how often, how much, I always meet with parents first whenever possible. They're always accepting. And I would say never meet with kids without meeting a parent. But I almost always ask them to meet with parents first. Why? Because they have to be applying to my philosophy of counseling. What is that? Informed consent. Informed consent says, here's my approach to counseling. And if they don't like my approach, then I want them to go somewhere else with somebody that they don't like. But I'm going to be unapologetic that here's how I best know how to help and serve my family. And if you're not comfortable with that, then I'm probably not the right person. And there will be people that they can probably find will be comfortable with and will stay that way. But I do say things like, I always have to meet with parents first for a couple of reasons. One is, parents think that they can tell you things without telling you things about the child in the room, right? So So I'll ask a question and everybody's silent. And I'm waiting for somebody to answer. And then maybe I turn to the team and stop answers. And behind them, parents. And I'm like, no. No idea what these people are trying to tell me. But they're obviously trying to tell me the opposite. Or I'll say, so tell me what brings you here. And the team will say, oh, no, my mom and dad just had problems. And I'm talking about. So there's always this lip reading or the what's not getting said in the room, or the parents trying to somehow say, well, it's a little more than that. Okay. Well, will somebody fill in the counselor in the room? Because I don't know what's going on. So they're always trying to say things without saying things, and I'm just trying. We want this free freedom, unfiltered, right? Well, parents feel the unfiltered early on, so it's astute before we get this file. So I'll have parents say, well, my kid is really anxious to be hurt, but they won't talk with us in the room, or they, whatever it might be, and I'll say, that's okay. I really want to meet with you first. I want you to make sure I'm not a crazy person. When you should care who you're sending your counselor to. That's your child. Point given, right? You need to know who you're sending your child to. You need to make sure I'm not a crazy person, that I'm a good fit for my son or daughter, and please believe me for a lesson. I want parents to be trained not just to stand their kids over to anybody. Intervene, make sure that you agree with my philosophy. Second is, I want you to be able to talk as much as you need to about the issues going on in your home, what's going on without your son or daughter there. So be unfiltered, let me know again. I can ask questions I can't ask of the young person in the room. There's all kinds of good information you get if you need to be transparent. Thirdly, what you and I need to know is, I guess at half the time, maybe a third of the time, maybe 25% of the time, I think it's important not to bring this son or daughter at all, but to let me transparent. And they are the experts at the end of their children. I'm just saying, parents are really the experts. I'm just going to get thrown out with the experts on the end. And what they already know, I learned in less than an hour or two, and it would take me 3 months to learn from their child. Why? Because you spent thousands of moments with your son or daughter reading what makes them happy or sad or their caught book. I was joked, I tell the most stories about my son William because he's the most open to letting me tell stories about him. But William, since they're tiny, 3 years old, has this great caught book, like a year in headlights. So I say, William, did you do this to God? And his caught look, he's now in his 20s. His caught look is still there. But it's only like 2 seconds. And I have to be watching his eyes through that caught look. You and I would be in the room watching him, and you would miss it in the heart, but you wouldn't know his caught look. But I'll know if I say, William, did you go to where the scripture were going to go tonight? I see it right in your eyes. So a couple years ago, he wrote me a Mother's Day card. It was something about, he's always saying funny things about being suffering to your kids or something. And so I wrote something about that, and then he said to my mom, human life practice. Well, the irony is he's the one giving me away. I'm not talking about reading life, I'm reading him. As a mom, I learned to watch my children and read them. But see, you guys, you can walk in the room and somebody's acting funny. It could be your spouse, it could be your kids, and all of a sudden they're acting funny, and you stop. And you don't know what it was, but you know they were acting funny. As opposed to how much time it's taking to read some of those books and the questions for a young person. But if I'm willing to sit and talk to a parent, how much more can I learn if I know how to ask them questions? So I'm drawing them out and asking questions by telling their personality, telling what they're like, what they're not like, finding out what the issues are, finding out what the parental issues are, how do you discipline? Are you both in agreement with how you discipline? Are you in agreement with the issues? Because a lot of times it's part of the problem, right? That the parents are polar opposites of how they're doing with the young person. So that by the end of it, often I can say, hey, would you guys consider not bringing your son or daughter in yet and letting me meet with you for a couple sessions to try to help you walk through how to handle this? And then if it doesn't work, we feel like you still need help, then bring them in. And many times I can convince the parents to say, okay, let's do that. Or they'll say, well, I never thought of doing that before. Well, before you bring them into a professional counselor, it's like you're picking your children up and putting them in a sterile environment and expecting that we'll see what's going on. Sometimes you do, but sometimes you don't. It's happening in the context of school, or it's happening in the context of home. And for a lot of kids, going to counseling is a lot like going to the dentist's office. which is why we talk to you all about why you want to create an environment of culture that just wants to come back. So anyway, for all the reasons, from a counseling standpoint, I'm saying, consider meeting with parents first. At least the first session, I'm always saying, and if I can rope them into two or three sessions, I try to rope them into two or three more. Often, because there's a lot more I can learn from them after before meeting my son or daughter. And I always want to give as much information to make it as successful as possible. So if I say, hey, is your 9-year-old like to color? I know they hate coloring. They'll be miserable if you have to do anything with artwork. Oh, that's really good to know, because I would have messed that up first thing. Or, my child will really just talk to her. They'll be really upset if you bring the subject up. You mean the subject that you're really going to hear from counseling? Yeah, don't bring that up. So help me understand how that's supposed to work. Well, you're the counselor, right? I suppose you'll have to figure it out. And so we're talking through what's appropriate expectations even for counseling. And the way you can parents and surprise what easily does is when they're about and let you talk to them and you say, yeah, I want to know anything that's going on. Yeah. You don't want to know anything. So many times, and this is more true with elementary age kids for sure, but many times if the child wants the parent in the room, guess what? I want them to know the parent. Very different philosophy of counseling than most of us, right? They don't want the parent in the room. They spoil that what's going on, or they ruin it. And for sure, parents can answer for kids, or think of answers to shut the children down. So you have to do preparation with the parent. So, if your son or daughter would like to be in the room, all the better, because I want you to be doing it. You're their wise counselor. My job is to keep yourself out of the child. So that's my informed consent early on. I say, I really believe as parents, you're the expert at knowing anything. And my job is to work myself out of the job. So as much as I need to your son or daughter, I want to meet with you, so I want to help you know I've helped them long term, so they don't need to do anything. That is different than most therapeutic models, you see that. But that is a difficult one. So do you see why thinking biblically about this disease to start with is so foundational? Can you be very professional? Do you guys want to help you do it? And I think that many secular trainings with therapists that are coming to the same conclusion, and they're saying these children are not coming out of their vacuum. They're coming out of their family and their system, and why are we not working with the parents? Because it's a dogma's worldview that believes that I'm the expert, I'll work with your son and daughter and bring them back to you. Not to mention, can we always trust the perspective of a 13-year-old?
Yeah.
And we've seen much damage done, and to be honest, it is notifying me to think that I would take at face value what kids and teens are saying about their parents or saying about their worldview without trying to balance it out to see what's actually true. And while counseling them based on their narrative, that may not be true. But as we know, even narrative. When you only hear one party and you don't hear the other, we always have to gauge how much am I getting an accurate picture. So what does Proverbs say? Seems right until the other goes along, right? So you want a more balanced view. You want to understand children are their parents are made to be their primary educators, their primary counselors. And my job is going to be with the parents to help them love these kids. So when I'm working with kids or teens, I'll often say, hey guys, as much as I'm working with you, I want to work with your mom and dad. You know why? Because they need to know I love you better. You think they need to know I love you better? I have in 20 years not had a child say, you know, I love you better. They're all like, yeah, they need a lot of help. They need to be done more often. That also helps break down like my spine on them. Am I like a private investigator that would point back to parents? Instead, what they can be saying is, you know, your mom and dad need to know I love you better. I want to help them for as much as they need to be able to do so that they'll know how to love you better as well. Not an awful for a long time. So I often do this when I've taught in seminary classes, I'll get up and I'll say, all right, I want you guys to start by telling me, what is a good example of family life in the Bible? Can whole family, ideal, this is what Christian families should look like. Yet I promise you a lot of Christian families come to you feeling upset, hurt, broken, that they're the only ones. These kids are acting out, or who are having problems, or going through a divorce, or whatever it might be. But you cannot find a example in the Bible that says, this is the typical, two parents living with all the laws in place, and all the children arise and call you blessed, and do everything you're supposed to do, and you're wrong, right? However, if I were to say, well, let me just say, you could find a relationship, right? Mother, daughter-in-law, husband and wife, you can see the relationships, because biblical principles of relationships are far more important than the roles that we emphasize. But most parents have a formulaic view of family and roles and how the children should act. And they don't follow these formulas. They get utterly discouraged and they resort to all kinds of unloving ways of parenting because their results don't work. They want the formula, and if I had the formula, then my kids will turn out fine. But that kid can have difficulties, and the kids can have problems. There is not a formula. And most parents will resort to yelling, beating, or loving ways of responding to kids because they're going to their body. It's the only way that they can do what I want them to do. So it works when you hear that, or it didn't work. I often say, well, it didn't work. I didn't get the result. But I argue that your job is not the result. Your job is to influence the past. It's not success that's the way you can all define success. It's God finding a faithful life. Faithfully parent my children, despite how they respond, the outcome is between them and the Lord. They are moral responders, those things to make sense. You and I have to stay in our lane as adults or as parents and say, God, help me to faithfully parent this child to the best of my ability, and I'm going to struggle with that. But the outcome is not up to me. And you and I can do that, and we can do as parents to do that, have to problem solve. Because they are outcome driven. How do I get my child up across the class? How do I get them to stop struggling with another? How do I do this? And indeed, you have to help them respond. But then we let go of the outcome and say, trust the outcome of the Lord. You need to faithfully, discipline faithfully, pursue them, faithfully build bridges with them. That's going to be your job, and you're going to struggle at that. Let go of the result. So, back to bad examples. You're going to get bad examples. We will be here for the next week. You're going to start with Genesis and work your way through Revelation, right? All of a sudden, you have what? Stealing at birthright, you have murder, you have incest, you have adultery. I'm not too much of that after all. If we start putting in context, so parents come into your room, your office, and come and talk to you with this perfect picture of what a Christian family should look like, they should come out after hearing talk about families in the Bible going, kids are too bad after all. I think I can handle this, right? You see how you come in with this opinion or this formula, you're going to feel a certain way about your home, your actual family. Because here's the ideal. Here's my ideal, so therefore I can't love my actual family. You look at what scripture models of family life, and all of a sudden you have no hope. So a lot of times it's our presuppositions. Right? And what someone here needs to use the language of godless thing, I really think it's the point of God. Only the point of God that our presuppositions are going to be off and our conclusions are going to be off. But a lot of counseling and a lot of people make great observations, and you and I are buying into that, especially in counseling young people. We're buying into the system of all kinds of language, and we come up with all kinds of things from helicopter parents to lawnmower parents to free-range parents. And we make each other feel bad instead of saying what is biblical and good. And those are the principles, and then we contextualize them to each home and each family. Instead of judging each other, because we don't want our kids to go on social media, but you and I go on social media all the time, and we're comparing people's lives. We're comparing their homes and their yards and their lifestyles and their vacations and how great their kids are doing, and then all of a sudden we look pretty bad about our kids. So you see how it doesn't work if I'm doing all these things, but then I bring my child to you and say, you counsel my son or daughter. But you're missing out on all the stuff that's going on that needs to change in the context of it, how that can be very harmful. So why do we struggle with this? A lot of different reasons. The pace of life, it takes time to build relationships. We're talking about relational stuff. not for you, not just due to freaking and having a good time. We're talking about very long-term ways to build emotional building. You have cultural priorities that Ron talked about. In a conference years ago, I read a quote from an atheist, and I'll have to find it again for you to start today tomorrow, where it is an atheist who talked very proactively about proselytizing the kids to win the kids. And Jesus reminds us that just like a missionary would proselytize, we need to go into the public schools and we need to convince them. So atheistic cultural views are actively proactively to win the kids. Most parents are utterly oblivious about that. How much this happens with me. If I were not a counselor, I would be aware, unaware of how bad it was for our kids to come to I'll come back to that. The cultural priorities, feeling inadequate, we value often compliance over dialogue. We look for quick fixes rather than the long-term visibility. So it goes back to this, we're so quick to serve the long of the same. Have you guys ever seen a documentary for this festival? Mm-hmm. Not to get you off the fast food, for me, it's my girlfriend's festival. But it's this proverbial guinea pig who is a vegan, is a healthy New Yorker, vegan, walks everywhere, is a pretty big. And he decides he's going to be the proverbial guinea pig and eat nothing but McDonald's for 30 days. And you have to be everything on the menu at least once. And what else? If you ask for it, if they say, would you like a super size, you have to say yes. Because while you notice, if John's ever want no longer, it's something of my words today. I talked too fast. They no longer ask, would you like a super size? Well, as a result, just got to do it. So he begins this. Within 2 weeks of his 30 days, he is lethargic. He's sick. He's nauseous. His doctors are monitoring him and he's suspect. What do you think? He is eating extremely good. He is not lacking for food, but sustenance is not the only nourishment. It's the message, right? He was getting sustenance every day, and nothing nourishing was happening. As a matter of fact, he was actually decaying. He was corrupting him. You see this principle in Scripture, especially in Ephesians, where it talks about edifying, building each other up, not tearing each other down. You see the similar language that are our relationships nourishing? Are they not just sustaining? Did you do your homework? Did you get back from school? Did you get your stuff done for tomorrow? Are you did you do your homework? Are you did you get a show? Are you getting bed? Are you start all over again in the morning? And we feel pretty good because we got through a week of a hectic week. I call that a fasted lifestyle that our families are living on. They are communicating just enough to keep things going, but there's nothing even nourishing. Deuteronomy 6 talks about whether you're walking along the way, whether you rise or you sit down, whether you're driving in your family or doing, you talk about the things of the Lord. You don't. We're barely talking about how to get through the day and the accomplishments. It sustains. It gets us through the days and weeks. There's plenty of money in our marriages to sustain that, right? But it's not actually anything nourishing, it's discipleship going on. So our kids are going out into a godless world system where it's stronger than it ever was before, and they're going out without any training. Because we're feeling good that we're just getting their homework done, and keeping them going, and getting them to their school activities or to church activities. But we're not sitting down and really growing up without anything. We're not doing that often in our own relationships with each other, right? Just going by the wayside. One of these days, I'm going to write a vlog about returning to the potluck dinners. Not because the potluck dinners were so yummy, but because it was communal, right? It was community. People stayed after church and fellowship and mm-hmm. relationship together. We're not doing that anymore. We're not doing that anymore. And so, the fact that we have counseling role, absolutely, you and I need to be equipping parents to slow life down enough, be willing to make the sacrifices and say, it's not just about getting the victory, it's about developing character. So, parents need to be the experts at knowing their own family. It also needs to be about helping drawing them out and showing them how much they really know about their kids. They may be part of the problem, but they always need to be part of the solution. That's kind of a mantra I say, that sometimes parents are part of the problem. They're the ones that need the counseling, or they just need help to help their problem counseling. they only believe in part of the solution. Some presume that every child comes to counseling because of their bad parents, but they are wonderful parents doing everything right for their children's control. But they always believe in part of the solution. So are we training and working with the parents and partnering with them? Just think how much sense does that make that you can come to you maybe an hour a week or 15 minutes in, and then they leave, they go back into the world they're in the rest of the week. And then they come back a week later, and you've got 15 minutes of them again. And is that 15 minutes magically going to change the parents? Usually not. Maybe you've got them for a year or two. But even then, is that what we're going for? So children interpret life and their world and their experiences, whether or not we talk to them about it. So often we avoid talking about hard things. The parents have to say avoid talking about hard things. Why? Because, well, if they're not talking, not thinking about sex or homosexuality or gender issues, not thinking about sexual abuse, and I don't want to bring that up because I don't want to scare them. I don't want to sully the plot, whatever we're going to say. But think about how that naturally could be a shame of relationships that it shouldn't, like sex and gender. We need to proactively shape our children's views about gender. It's far better to proactively shape our views than go back into both and act. And we wait far too long. It's not that we over-educate our children, we under-educate them. We have one-time conversations. We don't talk to them well about stuff like this. And even in counseling, sometimes we tiptoe around it. So I supervise a lot of interns that are truly, I'm not going to talk to these kids about having sex with their boyfriends and girlfriends and stuff, and I'm so uncomfortable, I don't want to talk about it. And I'll say, you've got to stick it to me. What do I mean by that? You and I have to model being comfortable, even when we're having uncomfortable conversations, because you send a signal that this is the same topic or not a same topic to talk to kids about. And certainly in counseling, that's true. And parents all the time. And many of us in this room grew up with parents who didn't talk about these issues and feel the need to. So children will learn about it, and you won't like to be able to talk. It's all around them, everywhere they go. Children watching Blue's Clues and Caillou are seeing commercials of imagery of romance and sexuality and gender confusion. But if you and I are not talking to them about it, they're getting a message from someone. So I've done talks about safety with a Secret Service man. And I asked him, he actually gave this example one time in a talk. I asked him if it was true where when you're studying, you're detecting, that's the word I want, when you're detecting counterfeit money, how do you know it's counterfeit? And he says, you spend thousands of dollars studying the real thing. You learn the real thing first so that you spot the counterfeit. There you have it. That's our takeaway. Why are we waiting for our kids to be corrupted by the news of the world before we talk to them about hard subjects rather than proactively teaching them about gender and sexuality? God creates the world. We're afraid to talk to them about these topics because we think, well, maybe they'll lose their innocence. But if that's the real problem, what are you believing about God's creation? If God creates sex, they're not losing their innocence. They are known how God intended. And if you're not talking to them about sex and gender sexuality, you're certainly not preparing them for those things you bring them from abuse. And how will they make sense of that? So you've got to be proactive, not reactive. They've got to learn from all the right places and from a redemptive biblical worldview. Mary got Deuteronomy 6. I love this because it just is all about all the disciples and kids are talking about the things that we're working for, how we're doing that in ministry, in counseling, informally, or not informally, whatever your ministry position is, just building a relationship with our kids, and it's making it right there in our faces, and it's building the connections for them. It's connecting the dots accurately for them. It's doing this. So, years ago, when my kids were much younger, my oldest was maybe 11 years old, and we had family vans, we had 5 kids, and so we were driving somewhere in the car, and my daughter, completely out of the blue in the back seat, said, "Hey, Mom, is there sex in heaven?" About to off the road. In the world. So, and everybody got quiet. No pressure, Julie. love that question. It ever crossed my mind. And so the temptation was, hey, look at that ball of Israel now. But instead, I did the typical counselor thing, and I'm like, the same question, is there sex in heaven? What do you think, Brittany? And she pointed it back to her, so 11 year old. And she goes, well, you said sex was good. I'm like, okay, now I'm trapped in. So well, you said sex was good, is sex in heaven? So I'm like, well, thankfully I was there and seeing what all this is going on. And I said, well, I don't know that every God is best, that's just good, but I don't know that everything God created is going to be in heaven. Or everything that's good, that's good. I don't know if everything that's good is going to be in heaven. And then one of the kids types up, well, what else isn't going to be in heaven? Oh, dear Lord. ice cream. I don't know. Ice cream's good. I don't know. Ice cream would be in heaven. And all of a sudden, the van was doing uproar. I'm like, why did that question come up? Tuesday, I'll let you know. Why am I letting you know? How did you ask that question? Think of the hundreds of thousands of questions that this week. And you and I, either are going to draw them out or we're going to silence them. We're going to foster environments that encourage them to communicate and talk for the strength of them. That really counts to me as well, that you and I have to do the hard work, the missional work of drawing them out and encouraging conversations and encouraging them to say things that they have learned for years aren't safe to say in their own home. So you see, we're doing more work because we're another adult like their parent who probably is not doing those things. Well, they may be, and you can tell right away because those kids come in and they ask their own questions. They're honest with their problems. But then, all this is just informing why we know parents have to be a part of us. They have to be one of our goals in counseling. So, as I said, be proactive, not reactive. It's better to proactively change a child's understanding of any subject we're talking about than to try to go back and debunk and act. So I often say counseling cases like a puzzle, and I talk to parents this way too. When I'm meeting with them, they'll say, I just don't understand what's going on. Is it developmental? Is it a learning disability? Is it this? Is it that? I'm like, I don't know. I'll definitely try to and I'll say, but here's what we're doing. It's a lot like a puzzle. Think of throwing a puzzle out on the table to fix. And where do you start? I'll start with the edges. The thing that you do. So let's start there. What are the things you know about your son or daughter? I don't know, they're a mystery. Well, tell me some things. Like, tell me about their personality. And before you know it, they're always telling you, oh, they came out of the womb, high energy, excited, and running around, and they really like sports, and they're really athletic, or this one's really shy and timid, but they're a follower, not a leader. And before you know it, you're writing this down, and you're building the edges for them, a puzzle, a thing that they already knew, but they didn't know. Now you have a bunch, 100, not 1,000 pieces in the middle that we don't need to do it yet. Now often you've got metaphors saying, that's what we're going to do now. We're going to put the pieces together and I'm here to help you. And sometimes we won't put together accurately by that. We'll pick up two pieces that look like they fit together, right? Only to later find another piece and go, oh, this one actually matches with this, not the other one. That's true when, especially kids who have any learning disabilities or particular struggles that we don't know the behavior, is it weakness, is it inability? I know here, but we'll figure it out. Sometimes when parents have to go through specific testing, I encourage them with that picture because testing sometimes rules out what it's not. So just like you can get frustrated that you keep picking up these pieces of puzzles and it doesn't fit, this one doesn't fit, this one doesn't fit. I'll say, yeah, but you just learned 50 don't fit. And then we're going to find the one that comes to it. And so the process can be discouraging for parents as well because they're coming and they think you're going to give them a quick fix rather than saying this is a process. And you who have spent years, if not thousands of moments to think about, don't know yet, neither do I. But guess what? We have a roadmap for how to figure it out. And I'll walk along with you and help you figure out. You need to be part of the process because you have a lot of important information. And sometimes there are things you're doing that can change that would help. So the picture of puzzle can be really helpful when you think of what's their temperament, what's their strengths and weaknesses, where do they have kinds of disabilities, where is it suffering and situational hardships that have happened around the hard part of these things. Here's another picture. Mike Emlich, he is a colleague of mine, he came up with this triangle, sinner, sufferer, and saint. And he talked about how we're all, this is kind of a picture for us as counselors in ministry, people in ministry, that every child we meet with is a child of God. They're an image that we are trying to help. They're also sinners. They struggle. They're making mistakes. They have behavior issues. Parents often bring their children into the room. But they're also sufferers. Our children come with brokenness, with hardship, with trauma, with abuse, with weakness, with anxiety, with all kinds of struggles. So there are all these things. That's a biblical picture of how we need to think about this as they come to us. I guess, by the way. What I put in the middle is the individuality of each of us. Every one of us in the room is just, we're all the same, we're all sinners, sufferers, and saints. But we all are very different people with different strengths and weaknesses and aptitudes and temperaments. And that's where I'm helping draw parents, draw out their kids to tell me about their strengths and weaknesses. Tell me what they have. Tell me about their temperaments. Tell me what they like to do and their free time. Tell me about the things that make them upset or make them happy. What are their interests? I'm collecting as much information as I can because I want to build a puzzle. I want to build a bigger picture. So there's a couple different answers. The other thing is knowing kids well. So what does that mean? Here's where I see parents often struggle, and you and I struggle as counselors. We're trying to figure out, some parents will come in and say, there's just disobedience all the time. All the time there's disobedience. Sometimes it may be an intention, it may be struggle. Or the parents come in that they're always making excuses for their children in bad behavior, right? Oh, they're just great. As they're going around church, throwing everything around the okay? Or they're just filling the blank. So sometimes you have parents on the side of excusing bad behavior. Other times you have parents who are taking weakness and struggles and are turning into disobedience, but that is what's not. You and I want to be wise to figure out what's really going on. So you see a character, these adult traits, godliness, patience, honesty, courage, integrity, kindness. Those are the developed traits. Then you have temperament, which are innate qualities. They're either extroverted or introverted, and they're either more of a leader or follower. You saw more aggressive, more passive, more loud, more quiet. That we tend to put character labels on. So a more aggressive child gets labeled as bullied or as a difficult child, which they could be. But they also might just not, they might be like a bull in a china shop. They have a good heart, they might be tempting to bulldoze over people, but they're rough and they're unaware of how big they are compared to other children, and so they begin to get them. Then you have in the middle where character and innate qualities become really confusing. And I listed a couple of examples, like sensitivity or empathy. We know people in the spectrum struggle with empathy. Attentiveness, organization, memory problems, are those sin issues? Not necessarily. And then these sin issues. So here, I love the fact that I'm working. I'll give you an example. I'll often and constantly pick on myself. So I'll say, Julie, I've always been doing. Since the time I was little, I can either be a godly Julie, or I could be an ungodly Julie, unmarried, but I never stop being Julie no matter which one I am. Why is that important? Well, I'll give you a sample. I've said this before, but when I was little, maybe 5 or 6 years old, we lived about a block away from the local SPCA. And all the stray animals. And for reasons I still don't understand, people didn't walk their dogs into the SPCA. They often just drop them off outside the SPCA and they'd be running around. And my parents thought for sure there was a magnet always drawing them back. Because they end up in our yard. And then there'd be a little Julie who was 6 or 7 years old. Please take this dog. And I would be crying, my heart would be broken, I can't be out left out in the pool, and I'd secretly take the food out there and feeding them. Another story, When I was probably 15, I had my first birthday party. And my mom said, after the boy went to invite him, started listing off the people in the class. I said, well, those aren't your friends. I said, no, I'm inviting you people because they're all your friends. I wasn't godly at all. You see how we put a character falling on that, though. I was a bleeding heart at 6 years old. I had a heart for the break and the lost, four-legged or two. I am now an adult who has fostered for 20 years. I'm a counselor and I'm adopted 5 children and have 20 more testimonies with me. Am I still seeing you? Yes. I'm hopefully a godlier Julie, hopefully a more mature Julie, hopefully a more balanced, more balanced Julie, right? But that's just me. Because see, part of the problem is we want our kids to change, or we want each of us to change, for God gives us freedom for individuality. God gave me these 5 radically different children. And if I parented them all the same, I'd be messing every one of them up. This is why parents they need the freedom to say, God's caused you to know your children, be an expert in knowing your children. Not for me to be an expert, but for you to be an expert in knowing your children. And I want to teach you how to love them better. And sometimes, I've heard over and over again over the years, I can't tell you how many times I've heard parents say, Julie, counseling has been so helpful, but not for the reason you do. Okay. I don't think anybody else. It's just that we spent an hour from your person and slowing down to really get to know our son or daughter, or that we brought our son or daughter and we felt it was special for you. Isn't that sad that you have to go ahead and counselor, spend one-on-one special time with your son or daughter and slow it up? It's a benefit when you really taught them to slow down and really know your kids and say, your job's not to change. Your job is to make sure the godly is worthy of what you can do. Our job isn't to change any of our 5 kids, but to help them do the godly is worthy of who they want to be. So what are we fishing for Julie? Well, for the life of me, I can't do math. Some of you might think that's particular, but I'm not even math collecting. I used to think I didn't like driving until GPS came out. Then all of a sudden I'm like, I love driving. I just keep finding the place you want to go. And now I have something that talks to me and just recalculates every time I turn down the wrong lane. I actually like to drive. I come to the wrong conclusion that I didn't like to drive, but really it was I didn't like finding places. And I hated trying to read a map. And now I have something to do with me. You see, parents do this and kids do this. They come in going, I'm stupid. Or I'm not good because they struggle in school. And so they think they don't fit in, they think they're not smart, but they're struggling in different ways, and so they come to all the wrong conclusions. So I want you to think for a minute. Anybody come up with a picture yet? One. This is a great counseling principle for adults as well, that we are often trying to build pictures of things, and we connect the dots in all the ways. Often because we're missing the next number. But we think we have it right. And so this happens in marriage, right? I know exactly why my husband did that. Right? I know exactly what was going on. We start connecting dots. Only to later find out, and it looks like the picture is supposed to be. Only to later find out, oh, I didn't connect the dots the right way, and it makes a whole completely different picture. So when you stop for a minute, what if I told you that this was a koala? Could you draw? Go ahead and draw. Take a minute, literally. I'm making you do it. You're going to do more of these, so be here for the torture. Can you draw a koala out of this? Right? they're telling us, and they're connected to God in their lives, and why things happen a certain way, or how they happen. This is true of young people. I'm using it here, but I use it all the time with, that's how you're connecting with God. And I'm sure that that happened. I'm positive this is exactly what's going on. Mm. And I think they're going to pick up to offer. Only when you're hung up, because you're really lost. But the way it connected to God made it so abundantly clear that it was a flaw, that this was what was going on. Mm. But they were missing numbers, and they were missing pieces, and so they rewrote the story, or they rewrote and got the completely different picture. But that's right, you and I were going to choose to leave the narrative or not, right? And sometimes all we have is the narrative in front of us, but I'm unfortunately to be much more careful in the story. Because I can look back over the years and think, I wonder how many times I connected. And I helped instill wrong views for people that should have been instilled that live in America. Mm-hmm. But to God's word, it's connected back to it. Anybody able to build a flaw in it? Mm-hmm. Now, like I told you, it wasn't a flaw. You see how I can make this be several different things, right? They could be a clown. They could be a dog. They could be a lot of different things. If you envision it, and all of a sudden you can start to connect the dots in a different way, you see that that should be a sobering impact for you. That how we connect the dots with people and all we do is ask them. And I say sometimes we don't see it when we do it, but it will make us more wise and cautious in the process. We'll give a benefit of the doubt, but I'll often wait and measure them and try to ask better questions that hopefully discern, is that really what's going on here? Or is that the way they connected to God? So God tells us to be careful with them. It's great energy, because then you take somebody and you say, I want to get to know them, they're a puzzle. And the thing about kids is they're still developing. They're still unfolding. You don't have all the things. You only might have for 5 minutes, right? Because what's developing and maturing and what is actually moving on. And people do change, but we innately are who we are today. This side of heaven, the day I die, I'm going to care what people think of me. I hope I care a lot less. I hope I'm not ruled by it, right? So in my 2 years, did I live with fear of man issues? A sensitive person is going to care what people think about me. Hopefully, as an adult, I care a lot less from what I'm not doing. Some people struggle with empathy. And so the day they die, they might struggle with empathy, but they've gotten a little better. Right? So we don't give a lot of freedom in the church community to very different people as the body of Christ calls us to. We respect people who are what, more extroverted, who are more eloquent with their words, whatever it is that we respect in the church community, respect human beings. And for kids who are all spending 6 to 8 hours a day in the same class or the same structured environment, doesn't get a lot of freedom to do that, does it? You're told and taught to conform in ways that can just suffocate you because they don't naturally conform to that environment. And parents are buying into the lot. So this goes back to something Ryan said. If you think about a toddler who's swimming or you're teaching to swim, what do you do? You don't throw them into the pool, right? You put all the swimming devices on them. Good parents will often get in the pool with them. If you're sewing, you get them comfortable putting their feet in the water, and you slowly ease them down. Now you're going to throw them on the ready to swim? Okay. Why not?
They're not prepared.
They're not prepared. They don't have the skills yet. They don't have the muscle skills. They don't have the practice. Now, what if I moved deeper and deeper in the pool before they were ready? I was going too fast. I was expecting them to develop a swim at the same pace that everybody else in the class was swimming. Now imagine, parents are different. Here's where we have liberty. Some parents will get in the deep end with their kids, but they're still checking the guards. Some parents will let the kids get in the shell and they'll just let them have at it and play and run around and fall face first and jump up really quick. That's how you learn. But every parent is different how we teach their kids to swim. But there's also boundaries for what we consider good and bad ways to teach them to swim. Like throwing them in the deep end of the pool, or taking them to the river, or to the ocean, and saying, I'm going to teach you to swim in the ocean. You're not necessarily the smartest thing. Some who grew up in rural environments might say, yeah, I felt like this was going to be pretty quiet and shallow, small, it wasn't fast-paced. Thomas can't always do it when he needs to. My question is, what about really good swimmers? Don't good swimmers drown? How is it even the best swimmers drown? Unaware of the current or the undertow? They're unaware of what's in the water? So I'm always surprised every year. We live up near Pennsylvania, New Jersey shore, and we're always hearing of drowning or surprise things that happen, that even good swimmers drown because of the current. Yet, our kids are drawing in their current that's so much stronger than you and I are. But we're expecting them to not get involved in sex or social media or addictive things on technology. That even the best swimmers, and you and I can't go to a restaurant and look around and often find a table where nobody's on the cell phone. But we expect our children to practice that kind of self-discipline. We expect them to not struggle with things online. So really the kids that are growing up in wonderful families, are joining youth groups, their parents are doing everything right, end up in counseling together and spending naked photos back and forth to boys. And the parents are mortified, they cannot have a shot, they can't understand what on earth would convince them to do that. And I'll meet alone with a teenager in this way, everybody knows it. So I just feel like, what's so wrong with everybody doing it? They are swimming the current that they struck in the bottom. The current is so strong. So you and I are afflicted. We're shocked by it. Why? Because that wasn't the current we were swimming. But we assume that our kids should know better, and we are teaching them. But are we teaching them enough? And even strong kids drown in the current because the current is stronger than you and I could ever. And that's part of the dilemma that you're going to work with this population that understand how strong the current is. We have got to be more aware of what's going on. We've got to get invested and know the dark side of a lot of things that are going on so we're not struck by it, so that kids don't think we're struck by it, so that we help parents understand the current is so much stronger than we have. And again, if I was in a counselor, I would teach them how strong the current was, especially those social media, and how good kids are at hiding things or how they're being taught things. So even if you have a child who's not so smart, if he's naive, and by what they be doing on their own, all their peers around them are going to be doing it, showing them how. Children without cell phones are getting on the bus and watching pornography as they go to school because the kids next to them in the bus have it and are introducing them to it. You are not immune from this just because of the technology we're doing in this country. That's not the issue. As I said, our kids are going to be doing well and not part of the world. We've got to give them the skills to go out to the world and know that and the places to have them. So you see, like, it's really helpful to get the parents back to be part of the counseling process. But we hear all the time, and we're buying into it in a lot of Christian counseling circles, that we separate kids and parents. Now again, the philosophy of counseling can be very different. There are teenagers I'll meet with regularly for weeks at a time, and they go infecting with parents. Why? Because they're mature, they're motivated, parents are doing everything right, so we're less proud of the parents. The team will go home and tell parents, but we're working really closely and often encouraging them to do. And there's teenagers where I wish the parent was in there every single session during what I was saying, and that we're working really together. And then there are parents and teenagers whose relationship is so broken, you can't have them in the same room together because it would be damaged. You wouldn't want them together. So the whole idea, having wisdom and discern when and how to do it, that we don't just rely on some kind of formulaic approach to it. So let me stop there. Any questions? We're going to have a ton of questions throughout as well. But any thoughts or questions before we often hear it's quality, not quality, right? And I will argue against that. Because I think it's both. Not one or the other. Don't spend your time. It's the fast food lifestyle. And sustenance doesn't make you feel much. Yes.
We were talking about the work with the Vaynerchuk. And you
My brilliant idea is to make parents and youth group. Yeah, but I actually think there's something about saying, there is something about youth group being friends with kids and separate from parents, but you are right, what that's done is create generational divide and unfairness. And we do that with marriage, we do that with guns, we do that with seniors. We divide everybody up into generational categories rather than blending it and making it generational. And the younger are learning from the older, and the older are being blessed by the younger and serving one another. So in youth group, there is something about how do we have time that is one-on-one parent to meet with you as well. I also think that I often use language of preach it from the pulpit means speak openly about wanting parents to be more involved with their kids, whether it's in the church or just relationally, and offering seminars and things for parents to go to. Even when that is offered, though, that's the lifestyle of a lot of people. I'm sure you get frustrated because nobody of parents don't come to the parenting seminars that are offered. All right, can you let you guys go for the night? We'll talk more tomorrow.